Right, so welcome to Flashback Part 3. We are here with Peter Olusoga. I nearly got it wrong there. And we're here to talk about Tommy Smith, one of the great athletes of our time that was known for raising his fist at the Olympics in Mexico. But first, I'd like to just have a bit of a conversation with Peter about what you do and a little bit about your background.
Okay, well, I'm a senior lecturer in psychology. I teach up at Sheffield Hallam University. My area of interest is stress and coping, burnout, well-being in high performance sport.
Okay, but I found you on
You
Twitter.
did, yeah.
And what are the narratives that you're talking about on there?
So I use Twitter not really to talk so much about work. I use Twitter to talk about, I guess it's kind of like a bit of social commentary, really. And I sort of found my voice to talk about things like race and racism probably about 5 years ago or so. So I do use Twitter quite a lot to talk about some of those issues that we're seeing in society at the moment.
And why did you feel like it was important to raise those views, to kind of put that out there, put your views out there to the public?
Well, it's really interesting because I didn't really talk about it so much, probably until Brexit in 2016. And during that period, we saw a kind of real uptick in racism and xenophobia and kind of racist incidents, hate crimes. And it was during that sort of strange period that I started to have these conversations a little bit more with friends and people I work with and colleagues. And some of those conversations were, how shall I put this? Interesting to say the least. There was a real kind of lack of understanding of lots of these issues, a lack of understanding of racism and how it works. And what I thought would be a useful thing to do was for me to write down some of those conversations. So I started off writing a blog about my conversations that I was having on race and racism in the 21st century. And that kind of spilled over into me talking a little bit more on Twitter and being a little bit more vocal and kind of really finding my voice. But it wasn't probably until I was about 40 that I really felt comfortable, comfortable enough in my own skin to really to do that and to put myself out there in that way.
And has it been positive?
Mixed, I say, largely positive, but there's always a backlash. I'll give you an example. I interviewed my brother, David Olusoga, for The Psychologist magazine just the other week. And it was an article on Britishness and kind of how Britishness is a really flexible identity. And within hours of that post going online, there was just a barrage of racist insults and racism just thrown my way. So yes, it's kind of largely positive, but there's always, when anybody speaks out like that, when anybody sort of dares to put their head above the parapet, there's always a backlash, and I've kind of grown to expect that a little bit.
Was it a surprise? I asked that because with some of the things that we've done here, when things have gone viral, say like with the Castor Painting Project, I was really shocked by the backlash that was received. And not to say by the backlash, the insults or whatsoever, but by the people it came from. That I kind of put sometimes, and this might have been, my naivety. That racism comes with ignorance. But then there's some really kind of quite intelligent, functioning people that have some really interesting views and aren't afraid to just tell you and be quite straight about it.
I think there's a deliberate ignorance involved in some of this because the facts are there to, they're plainly there, they're plainly available. Anybody with 45 seconds and an internet connection can go and look up, what happened at such and such a period in history. And some of the comments are so mind-blisteringly ignorant that there has to be a sort of deliberate choice to be ignorant about those things. So I think you're right. I think it is somewhat surprising that you think people who are supposedly well-educated and articulate and, you know, come across as intelligent can have some of these views when the information is readily available. Then that's a choice. You're making a choice to be ignorant.
Definitely. I definitely agree with that. So, as I say, we're here to talk about Tommy Smith.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my knowledge, I've always known about him, and, you know, we've all seen the pictures with the three of them on the podium and the two. And I've seen certain documentaries, but tell me from your perspective, what did you see as a psychologist standing up, seeing those two men raise their hand at that time and knowing that this could not only change their world, but, you know, it'll have an effect on others, but it's really going to, you know... Give it from your perspective.
Well, I mean, first of all, you're right. It's one of the most iconic images, arguably, of the entire civil rights movement.
Definitely.
You know, it's such a powerful image, those two athletes standing there with their fists raised. And I think if you kind of read the words of Tommy Smith himself, you know, he was very aware that there was going to be a backlash to this. And if you think about what happened in the period prior to the Olympics, you know, we've seen the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. It was just only 6 months before.
I didn't realize it was so close.
Yeah, it was really close, yeah. And then one of the things that really spurred them on to actually make the protest was that I think it was a week before the Olympics, the Mexican police opened fire on a student protest and killed 300 students in the range of 300 students. So originally they weren't actually going to attend the games at all. They were going to boycott the games. And this sort of series of events prompted them to think, okay, well, no, let's, you know, be seen, you know, let's kind of make an impact
here. Yeah.
But they were very aware of a potential backlash. I'm not really sure they were aware of quite the extent of what was going to happen. But to be able to do that, you know, to think about the pressure that you're under as an athlete anyway. And of course, they had to medal in order to be seen to make the protest. So there's pressure to perform as well. There's a huge amount of pressure going on there, knowing that as a black athlete standing up and saying what you're, you know, what you believe in, you're going to come under fire.
And how old were they? Because it was the two. It wasn't just Tommy. What was that? I can't remember.
So John Carlos.
That's it.
So yes, they were both students. They were students at San Jose State University. So Tommy Smith, I think, was either 23 or 24.
Right.
So when I look back at that now as a sort of grown adult, you realize how young that actually is.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, how brave must you be
to stand up and do that?
To stand up and
in front of the world as well. You know, it's not just a home crowd. This is the world that they were in front of. So it must have really taken a lot from them. And I've seen some bits about the other athlete that was there who said he wanted to put his hand up, but was too nervous about it. I mean, even that's an interesting concept, because he, you know, where do you sit in? I mean, I know we can't put our heads in his space, but, you know, wanting to support but not knowing if you can. And, you know, there's all those different elements that was happening at that point.
So what's interesting about that is that was Peter Norman, an Australian athlete, and he did participate in a way. So about a year or so before the games, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, along with a couple of other, a professor, I think, from San Jose State University, founded this Olympic Project for Human Rights. And like I said, originally they were going to boycott the games, but they decided to sort of leave it up to individuals, so they decided to protest. They made it very clear that it wasn't really about black power. They tried to distance themselves a little bit from that, that it was about human rights.
Right.
So Peter Norman, the Australian athlete, the white Australian athlete, was very much in support of what they were doing. So he actually wore an Olympic Project for Human Rights badge during the medal ceremony. So although he hasn't got his fist raised, he's participating.
I didn't realise that.
And he, like, arguably got the worst of it. So he went back to Australia and had his career completely ruined for daring to stand up in support of these two black men raising their fists at the Olympics.
And that is, you know, that's what we, you know, came to. Those young men, their careers was completely derailed after this one moment in time. And you know, what does that do to a person? You've been trying to train in, and you know, this is your path to stand up with some to something that you believe in and have your whole career totally derailed.
Yeah.
You know, psychologically, that must really, you know, I don't know how they came through that.
No, well, I mean, it certainly took its toll. So Tommy Smith, I think, wanted a military career, and that was over. They were thrown out of the Olympic Village. And originally, the US Olympic Committee actually protested against that. But then they got put under pressure from the International Olympic Committee, a guy called Avery Brundage, who coincidentally was a sort of strong supporter of the games in Nazi Germany and didn't have any problem with that. But he was very much against political protest, so he piled pressure on to the US Olympic Committee. So these two athletes were both sent home in disgrace, were thrown out of the athletes' village. They were basically treated as pariahs when they got home. They couldn't even get a lift home from the airport. It was a sympathetic black reporter gave them a lift home from the airport when they returned home.
You
know, they were met with jeers and boos and called traitors.
But they've just won medals.
They've just won medals, yeah. But it doesn't matter.
I mean, he came to Leicester at one point a few years ago, and I kind of listened to his story, but he didn't kind of go into it that deep to say they didn't even get a lift from... You've just won a medal for America for the US, and they didn't...
They were just sent home in disgrace. And found it really difficult to get jobs.
But I suppose in some ways they were calling out the American system. So I don't want to say I can understand it, but So it's, you know, I know that family-wise there was some issues as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, so I think Tommy Smith's marriage ended up breaking down. And, you know, we don't know the ins and outs and the reasons for that, but later on he said that, you know, the sort of stress and the pressure of what happened on their return to the US was kind of certainly part of that. Like I say, they found it difficult to get jobs. They ended up sort of doing menial jobs. You know, he did end up going and playing American football for a few years, so he had a sort of fairly short NFL career. And then ended up going into teaching. So it kind of, he ended up with a sort of decent career in the end, but that sort of period of returning home to the US was just, you know, these two black men dared to stand up for what they believed in and were just treated horrifically.
And when we look through history, I mean, this is something that happens quite regularly.
It absolutely is, yeah.
You know, if you dare to stand up as a you know, black man or woman, You get cut off at the knees.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, where does it stop? That's a bigger question that we can probably answer.
Yeah, yeah.
But it still seems to be happening now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, within sport, certainly, there's an intense double standard when it comes to athletes talking about issues other than their sport. So you have LeBron James, for example, one of the most recognized athletes possibly in the history of sport, when he dares to stand up and talk about issues that aren't, you know, related to the sport, he gets told to just shut up and dribble, stay in your place, stay in your lane. Yet when white athletes talk about, you know, issues outside of their sport, then they are just exercising their right to free speech. They have a right to be heard. We see this literally play out in the media time after time.
Yeah.
So there's this real intense double standard.
I mean, I think the biggest one to that is Colin Kaepernick.
Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah. See, me and names are terrible. I'm the world's worst with names. But yes, his whole career.
Yeah.
Gone.
Yeah.
Just because he dared to take a knee, and this is the same things happening again.
Yeah, I mean,
or is it, you know, from your perspective?
I think it is, yeah. I mean, I think you can probably draw a fairly straight line from Tommy Smith and John Carlos right through to Colin Kaepernick. And, you know, you could probably extend that line further back to people like Bill Russell, basketball player, who was really, really big in the civil rights movement as well as being an athlete.
Don't know about this one.
Tell me. Yeah, so Bill Russell, he refused to play and kind of got a lot of his teammates and the opposition team to refuse to play an NBA game because the team hotel they were staying at refused him service in the restaurant because he was a black man in the 1960s. So this is, again, before Tommy Smith and John Carlos.
I suppose even when we're thinking of Muhammad Ali as well,
yeah,
same thing.
Same thing, yeah. Career totally derailed. You know? Yeah. 5 years where it should have been the prime of his career, he was refused a boxing license in pretty much every US state, so he couldn't fight, which is ridiculous. But, you know, this line kind of extends back to, you know, Jackie Robinson in the 40s. And even beyond that, there was a guy called Moses Fleetwood Walker, back in the 19th century, who broke the color barrier some like 60 years before Jackie Robinson did. So, you know, even then, just daring to put yourself out there, like daring to be a black man playing in what is ostensibly a white sport, like that's a form of protest. And the bravery and the courage to do that at a time, you know, at that time in America is incredible.
So these are American athletes and stories. Do we have anything in Britain that is similar? That
in terms of sport, we kind of do a little bit more recently. So again, if you think about that line that extends from you know, way back in the 19th century, right through Bill Russell and Tommy Smith and John Carlos, right through to Colin Kaepernick, you know, it kind of extends to where we are now as well. With you know, I think if we don't have those athletes, then maybe we don't have Lewis Hamilton speaking up about, you know, racial injustice and wearing his Black Lives Matter t-shirts. You know, again, in a really, really white sport where he received a lot of flack for it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we don't have Raheem Sterling talking about, you know, the media treatment of black people and that double standard that we talked about before. Maybe we don't have Marcus Rashford standing up and kind of forcing our government to care about hungry kids. Maybe we don't have those athletes with that sort of rich history of protest, men and women. You know?
I'm just thinking that kind of like 40s and 50s, and I don't even, I mean, I'm not a sports kind of thing, but I can't really think of that many black athletes from the 40s and British. I mean, I'm sure they were there, but...
Well, I mean, there's a handful of black athletes in the sort of, again, in the history, sort of mostly football.
But,
I mean, you're looking at sort of up into the 70s before we've got like Viv Anderson's first player to play for England, play football for England. So it's kind of that sort of late 60s, 70s period where we're starting to see a little bit more of that influx of black athletes into sport.
Okay. So, I mean, when we're talking about those double standards in this country, I mean, you mentioned Sterling. I'm just worried I'm getting all these names.
Raheem Sterling.
And, you know, when you see the backlash of what he gets, and I know, and what the other gets, you know, he can do one thing and it'd be the same thing as a white player, but the backlash is totally different. It seems like we do things just slightly differently in this country. You know, it's still just as bad, but there's a different way that it's performed.
I mean, I'm not sure. I think there is that real double standard, and I think it sort of stems from this idea. We still have this idea that, you know, black athletes, singers, entertainers, are kind of there for our entertainment. Like, that's what they're there for. So as long as they're performing well, and as long as they're playing well, then everything's good. And as soon as they slip up, so as soon as maybe they don't perform as well, or they step out of their lane and dare to say something, you know, seems uppity, maybe, that's when we have problems. And I think back to 2021, the European Cup Finals with the football team, and we have Marcus Rashford and Bukayo Saka and Jadon Sancho, three black players, or three players of colour who missed penalties. And they lost in the final. And the horrific and very, very predictable that those players got was absolutely awful to see. But again, you know, and I don't know if you felt the same, but I think pretty much every black and brown person in the country, as that was happening, before they even missed, was sort of like, oh no, they're going to get it.
Yeah.
But it, again, it speaks to that real double standard of you're there to perform, you're there for my entertainment, and as soon as you step out of your lane or as soon as your performance dips, like, it's just, it's free reign. I can go in on you. But that sort of anger and hostility turns racial very, very quickly.
Very quickly, yeah. And I mean, I at that point, I remember a conversation with an old school friend that, you know, some, because of what I do, some people are like, oh, you know, you're on that trail, you know, especially kind of the white old friends that I have. They don't want to talk about certain subjects or whatsoever. And I remember there was one guy, real football head, that rang me up out of the blue, not spoken to him for God knows how long, out of the blue, and went, Tara, I think you're right. Because I've just been in, and I've just been watching the football, and I was really, really disgusted about what I heard. And I just thought, well, I don't know, why are you ringing me? Because I could have told you this. But I think in some ways, some people, it shocked them that there was a realization. Because I think once, that was after George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, when, you know, people were like, we're not racist here. This doesn't happen here.
Yeah.
No, how could this? It's over there, and there was quite a comfort level in that it was over there and it wasn't here and we weren't as bad and you know that kind of idea, and then when that happened, it was kind of a bit like it was more like an old ear, So it was there was a lot going on, but do you think kind of thinking about what they went through and. You know, at that point, their mental health, what that would have done to their mental health at that point. And still, when we're looking at, now we have more, you know, there's more things, it's spoken about a lot more. I mean, I'm not sure it is spoken about as much to some of those young athletes that are out there presently. But back then, if we're going back to the Tommy Smith, what they must have gone through,
Yeah, I mean, like I said earlier, you know, there's the pressure of performance itself for any athlete, and anybody who's ever had to, you know, do something in front of camera or stand up and make a speech or anything like that knows how stressful performance can be.
Mm.
So there's that. And again, they had to win in order to be able to make that protest.
Yeah.
But there's also something called minority stress. So this was a guy called Ilan Meyer, and originally he was studying the sort of LGBTQ community. And it's this idea of minority stress, it's a stress that goes above and beyond what we would normally experience in our daily lives because of things like discrimination and prejudice. So if you think about the stress that these athletes were under, plus this sort of minority stress, which is, again, proximal stress, which is kind of the stress that this is like internalized racism, almost, that sort of internalized discrimination, or feelings that you are kind of expecting racism, you're expecting discrimination, and add that to what's called distal stress, which is the sort of actual discrimination that you experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Tommy Smith grew up in Jim Crow era America. He literally picked cotton as a child.
Wow.
So he's very, very aware that there's going to be this backlash. He's very aware as a black man that speaking up is going to have this impact on him. So all of that stress and all of that pressure must have been just mind-blowing.
And it must have been frightening.
Yeah. Well, he talked about the fact that, you know, he received death threats. So there was the booze in the stadium, obviously, during the actual protest, but he received actual death threats. Realistic threats to life. And again, having just witnessed the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X assassinated a few years previously, like, these are credible threats to life.
Definitely.
From a population that sees him now as a traitor.
I just, you know, you see that powerful image with them standing up with their fists in the air, but I kind of go back and like, what was going through your head? Because you everything must have just been in turmoil. You know, can I do, just even raising that arm must have been a real physical effort to like, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this, I've got this, I've got this. And then, you know, getting it up there. But so, I mean,
I think part of it was that they didn't really know what they were going to do until about 5 minutes before.
Yeah.
So they kind of were just making it up as they would go along. They knew they wanted to do something, but they weren't really sure what.
Because there was another guy that was meant to be doing it as well, wasn't there? The main guy that was that actually spoke to them about doing it was, have I got that wrong?
So I don't, there was the guy who founded the Olympic Project for Human Rights was a guy called Harry Edwards.
Right.
And he was the professor at San Jose State University. And again, they were going to boycott, and then they sort of left it up to the original, left it up to the individual athletes. So then they decided that, look, we're gonna protest. We don't really know what we're gonna do, but we're gonna do something.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Tommy Smith won gold. John Carlos won silver. Won bronze, sorry. They only had one pair of gloves between them. So there's the sort of raised fists, which are kind of the iconic part of the protest. But there's a lot more to it than that as well. So. You know, like I said, they sort of were keen to distance themselves from Black Power. So if you read into it, Tommy Smith's right fist was raised to bring attention to the power of Black unity within America. Oh, sorry, Black pride within America. Mm-hmm. John Carlos's left fist was about unity, Black unity.
I never knew that.
Yeah, they had John Carlos, sorry, wore beads around his neck to bring attention to the lynchings in the South. John Carlos, Tommy Smith, keep getting mixed up. Tommy Smith had scarves around his neck to symbolize Black pride. They both had bare feet and black socks to bring attention to poverty in the US. So it was a sort of the black gloved fists raised a sort of the iconic part of it. But there's a lot more to that protest.
I never realized,
bringing awareness to a lot of different things.
So there was a real, thought. You know, part of me just thought it was. And this is my ignorance, not knowing that much about the whole process, but that it was just really about the fist and putting the fist up. But even looking at it, I'm picturing it now, and I can't visualise that the two of them had the different hands. So it's that thought process that went into that such a powerful, iconic moment in our time.
It really is. And like you said, you know, the bravery to stand up and do that at that time, you know, during the civil rights movement is just phenomenal.
And the backlash that they were getting from it. I mean, to bring it up to today, which is something that has kind of annoyed me this morning, because on all my social media I was seeing yesterday that... And names again. I'm the world's worst with names. But the lovely gymnast.
Simone Biles? Yes.
Has become the most decorated gymnast of all time.
Yeah.
That happened yesterday. But this morning when I looked at the news, all I heard was about a young British guy that had won a medal. And I was just like, what's happening here?
You know. I mean, to be a black athlete in sport is difficult enough. To be a black woman in sport is even harder. And Simone Biles is, without a shadow of a doubt, the greatest athlete of all time.
Mm.
Closely followed, in my opinion, by Serena Williams.
Yeah.
And again, if we think about the double standards that are applied to black athletes and white athletes, but also male athletes and female athletes, you see... Serena Williams is often chastised for being emotional and aggressive.
Mm.
Novak Djokovic is passionate, right? Simone Biles dared to speak up about mental health issues at the last Olympics and took time out to prioritise her mental health, as she's entirely entitled to do, and just received, a barrage of abuse. She's, not good enough. She's like a coward. She's all of that stuff. And she's the greatest athlete of all time.
Yeah.
So there's this huge sort of double standard. And you've got people like Naomi Osaka as well, again, speaking out about mental health issues.
Yeah.
And just receives a sort of a backlash for daring to speak out.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, Simone Biles is amazing and deserves far more plaudits than she gets.
I mean, definitely. You know, to say that this is, it's only coming up on my feeds and not in the main news articles, yeah, which is, I'm really disappointed with some of the things that I've seen this week.
I mean, I understand the need to, British news focus on Brit, but it's something as iconic and incredible as that.
Exactly.
I think absolutely deserves it.
Exactly. And I was kind of waiting for it, and I was like, it's like that. Okay, fair enough. And then, and that takes you back, because that's two athletes that have had to take a back seat through their mental health. Mm-hmm. And, it takes us back to that, the research that you were talking about earlier about the minority.
Minority stress, yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
minority stress. Because that is a real thing, as you say, these athletes and artists not only are having to deal with the pressures of their training, but then there's the pressure of what they're seeing in the media. And at the moment, the media just seems to have full advantage on just taking everything, personal life, you name it.
Yeah.
And, how are the younger athletes coping with that?
I don't know. I don't know how I would cope with it. Mm. Social media, as we both know, is an absolute sewer. And I think trying to perhaps distance yourself from that, so kind of unplugging from social media a little bit. Mm. And some athletes do it very differently to others. So Steph Curry, for example, basketball player again, sort of very famously looks at Twitter at halftime. If he's having a bad game, he'll look at Twitter and see the negative comments and use that as fuel to sort of spur him on. Mm. Whereas other athletes will very much want to take a step away from that. And, because if you look at social media and you look at the barrage of comments that you're getting, not only from, the racist trolls, but also from the media, as you're saying, then that can have a real sort of negative effect on mental health. So really kind of unplugging from some of that stuff is perhaps one way of alleviating some of that stress anyway.
Is there any research happening about that?
There's a little bit. So I'm looking at the moment into my research is in high performance coaching rather than athletes. So I'm looking at some of the impacts of racism and discrimination that Black cultures experience, because again in this country as well as elsewhere, there's a kind of a sticking point in the pipeline between being an athlete and progressing, further than that off the playing field. So being a coach, being a manager, being a board member, there's a kind of real bottleneck.
Mm.
So we have, a third of the Premier League, for example, is Black and from minoritized ethnic groups. Yet the percentage of coaches is much, 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 much smaller than that. It's the same in most American sports, basketball is the exception. So within sport, certainly there's a lot of discrimination that has real impacts. So one of the things that I'm trying to look at a little bit is kind of what are these impacts? What are the impacts of discrimination on cultures?
And that's one thing that we know, that things can't change unless it comes from the top.
Yeah.
And unless we have those positions in some of the larger organisations. And I'm wondering if, if we think of Tommy's time and we think of today, what kind of differences would it make to have had somebody of colour in a position of authority within those Olympics or within the main boards at the moment? How do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a it's a difficult one to answer because, we have that a little bit. Like there are a sort of very small number of Black people and people of colour who sort of have risen to those positions of power. Is it making a difference? I don't know. So to think about whether somebody being in that position during Tommy Smith's time would have made a difference, I don't really know.
See, this is something that I kind of toy with, because I was having a conversation with Gus, well, not conversation, but I was at a lecture that Gus John had done, and he's very much of the idea that as long as we get black people into these positions, then that's going to make the change. And I kind of differ a little bit, because you have to have the right black people in those positions.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly the same. Representation matters, but it has to be the right representation.
Yeah, exactly.
And you only have to look at our current government.
Exactly.
To see why that is apparent.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm allowed to be political.
No, you are. You are.
You know, representation matters as long as it's the right representation.
And it's so important, you know.
Yeah.
Just having that face in there doesn't mean, because I don't even want to say the woman's name. I probably can't, because I'll get it wrong. But some of the rhetoric that's coming from Kemi at the moment,
yeah,
as well as the rest of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, Rishi, let's move on from that one, I think.
I think it's an important point, though, because I think if people in positions of power are using that rhetoric and saying those types of things, you know, comparing migrants to cockroaches and a hurricane, and, you know, we know what that language is about.
Mm-hmm.
But if people in positions of power and authority are saying that, and that's broadcast into your house on a daily basis,
yeah,
that's going to have an impact.
Yeah.
And that's going to feed into the way that you're thinking,
mm-hmm,
and the way that you see. And again, we see the impacts of that on the hostility towards migrants,
mm-hmm,
and other minoritized groups as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we think about that in the context of sport, well, yeah, people are going to treat people of color, black people, differently,
mm-hmm,
because they've been fed this rhetoric constantly. Mm-hmm. Through various media channels.
How do we change?
I think awareness. Mm. I think if you can see what's happening, and you can see that language that's being used, and you can understand what it's doing and why it's being used, then you can notice it and you can call it out. But I think it's so almost subliminal for a lot of people. And again, it comes back to that willful ignorance that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Right? But I think awareness is the key. And again, if I can just talk about sport for a minute, because I love talking about sport. You know, we think about the language that's used to describe players and describe athletes. So again, in football, there was a research study that looked at football commentary and found that when commentators are talking about black people and people of color, they're referring to their physical characteristics, strength, speed, the physical, yeah, the nicknames, things like, oh, he's a beast,
mm-hmm,
right? It's all very animalistic.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas white players are referred to more in terms of their intelligence and their cunning, yeah. That has an impact on how we perceive those players, and that's part of the issue in that sort of pipeline from playing to coaching staff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, physically you're capable, but are you intelligent and kind of, mm-hmm, clever enough to be, mm-hmm, a coach? Or, well, no. Same with we were talking about Simone Biles before. I watched the Olympics a couple of years ago, and the commentators were talking about the black athletes as being powerhouses, and they're so powerful and strong.
Mm.
And then the white athletes, the white gymnasts, were all elegant and beautiful.
Mm.
You know, and it's that language that's, you know, if you're not looking out for it and if you're not aware of it, you don't notice, but it seeps into your subconscious and changes the way that you think about the people that you're seeing in front of you. So awareness of that stuff, I would say, kind of understanding where that comes from and why it's used, sometimes quite deliberately, is one of the ways that I think we can perhaps unpick some of that stuff.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, that takes us quite nicely to the exhibition that we've just put on at Newark Museum, because it points out a lot of those things, and understanding where those narratives come from. And the pseudoscientists that have put those rhetorics together without ever communicating with any black people, without ever going to Africa, going to the Caribbean. They were developing these narratives where, when they were speaking about, you know, the Linneuses, the Carl Linneuses, and further on from there, about people, Edward Long, and all those kind of things. And when they spoke about black people, they spoke about their characters. They spoke about their, in some ways, some places, their genitals rather than who they were. But if they spoke about the white, they were experts and inventors and blah, blah, blah. And then they got to black people and they were, you know, they'd literally talk about their physical parts, which is, you know, so
it's crazy. It's the language that justified slavery.
Definitely.
And we're seeing it and hearing it still.
Still today. Today. Still with us. But that's because it's so deeply... and this comes back to that conversation about decolonization. It took kind of a good while for them to really entrench those narratives. Mm. And it's so deeply entrenched in society now, into the language, into the thought process, that it's as if people don't see it. They don't they don't even realize they're doing it half the time.
Yeah.
So to decolonize education, you know, museum collections, sports, anything, it's not a one-trip pony. It's not something that can just be done within a, you know, by just showing some black faces or this is, it's going to take us a long time to try and decolonize this society. If Bennett has to have that backing from others as well. Bring it back to sports for me.
I don't know. What do you want to know about? To give you the story of Arianna Smith.
Go on then.
So we talked about Tommy Smith and we talked about John Carlos and that sort of long line of protest. And we mentioned Colin Kaepernick and his taking the knee, and how that's perhaps, again, spurred on a range of different protests. We've seen in this country, so the England players taking the knee as well before Premier League games.
We haven't spoken too much about that, though.
No. I
quite like that the idea of that leading on on the protests, because that was the definite format of the process of cutting. Just delve in a little bit deeper for me.
Yeah, sure. So so we associate Colin Kaepernick with the Black Lives Matter movement, but it was actually a young woman named Arianna Smith. So a young black woman who played basketball at Knox College in Illinois. And she was arguably the first person to bring the Black Lives Matter movement into sport. And not a lot of people know her story, and I really think that they should. Again, college student, so young woman, young black woman, and they play the game in Missouri. And if you know America, you know that Missouri is perhaps not the place that you want to protest against racism.
Okay.
And this was a short while after Michael Brown had been killed by the police. Again, young, unarmed black man, shot, killed by the police. And during the national anthem in this game in Missouri, Arianna Smith walked out of the line towards the American flag, made the hands up, don't shoot gesture, and then lay face down on the floor for 4.5 minutes to represent the 4.5 hours that Michael Brown lay in the street after being shot and killed by police.
I never knew that.
Yeah. And again, can you imagine the bravery, the courage to do that? Do something like that. So she was, she would have been, I'm not sure exactly how old she was, but she would have been sort of like 19, 20, something like that. But to do that in Missouri as well, you know, just speaks volumes about her character.
Definitely.
But again, I think without that sort of long line of protest, maybe we don't have that. So then obviously Colin Kaepernick popularized that and sort of brought that to national attention with taking the knee as a protest.
And the backlash he got from, I remember the Trump...
Yeah, so, you know, Trump.
God, I mean, love him.
Yeah, bless his heart. So, you know, lots of the NFL owners, who again are old, rich, white men, basically colluded to get Colin Kaepernick out of the league. Donald Trump sort of fueled that fire as well. You know, wouldn't it be great if they could just say, you're fired, and kind of get out of the league? Mm. Sort of, again, that sort of rhetoric. So his career was completely derailed. Couldn't get a job. Still hasn't got a job. Mm. You know, he's still potentially a better hire than some of the quarterbacks that are in the league now, but still can't get a job. So again, another example of an athlete whose career essentially ruined and lost out on kind of, you know, millions and millions of dollars. This is his livelihood was taken away from him as well, because he dared to stand up for what he believed in.
And the England football team as well were taking the knee at quite a lot of places, but I know that wasn't gladly taken in some places, parts of the world, was it? Or even here to a certain extent.
This was I think this was during one of the first lockdowns, maybe, because it was shortly after George Floyd had been killed, and the England players, the Premier League players, and the England team as well, sort of got together and decided that they were going to show solidarity and take the knee before football matches. And as you can imagine, that was met with a lot of support, it has to be said, but also a bit of a fairly predictable backlash.
A lot of people kind of saw it. Or the perception that I got, that it was like an insult, that they were, you know, which...
Again, it's these sort of mental gymnastics that people make to try and turn something that is, okay, well, this is a protest against racial inequality, which, if you care to find out, absolutely exists. But if you are happy not finding out, that sort of deliberate ignorance, then you're going to see it as an insult. You're going to see it as a sort of an affront. Why are we talking about this? Why are they protesting on the pitch? Get on with the game. And again, it's that sort of stay in your lane, sport and politics don't mix type attitude. When we know that sport has always been a huge vehicle for social justice, it always has been. Athletes have always spoken out and used their platform, as they should do, to highlight some of these injustices.
Okay, well, I think it's been lovely speaking to you today, Peter, and thank you, because it's been really insightful. Kind of really pulling apart the ideals of protest and racism and what those athletes have to go through, from Tommy Smith right up to today. And hopefully people will start thinking a little bit differently at some point. But until then, thank you very much for being with us this week.
Thank you for having me.
And we will see you next week for our next Flash Black Part 3.